hire fast, I think it's complete nonsense. Suddenly call someone to your room and say, today's your last day. Like, never, ever, ever do that. Yeah. People have families, they have children, they have parents to support. You can't do that to people.
Yeah.
It has a negative impact on the culture you're building. No one in the company will ever trust the leaders because they'll always be watching over their shoulder that, am I next?
In this episode of Figuring Out, we have someone whose visa was rejected by the US authorities, which forced him to quit his job at Microsoft and come back to India. Later, he went on becoming one of the India's prominent players in e-commerce space and has invested more than millions of dollars in 200 plus companies like Ola, Urban Company, Mama Earth, and many more. We today have Kunal Bell, the co-founder of Snapdeal, and with him, we've discussed about how he received his first investment of $4 million in just a two-minute phone call. Things Kunal looks for in a startup before putting his own money. What leads to the doom or success of a startup and entrepreneurs? This episode of Figuring Out is powered by Bajaj Financial Securities Limited, a 100% subsidiary of Bajaj Finance Limited, a prominent name in the lending sector. It's a discount stockbroking company for traders and investors alike with a mission to make investing in the stock market easily accessible to everyone, even beginners. They've partnered with PickRight to offer you expert-powered stock baskets that are researched by AI and human experts. It helps you build your long-term portfolio without having to research yourself. BFSL also offers brokerages as low as 5 rupees per order for all trading segments, intraday, F&O, and delivery with their annual membership of Bajaj Privilege Club. Bajaj Financial Securities Limited also offers low interest rate for margin trade financing. You can avail margin on delivery orders and boost your capital up to 3.5x. Check out Bajaj Securities mobile app or bajajfinserv.in, the website today, and kickstart your investment journey. Investments in the securities market are subject to market risk. Read all related documents carefully before investing.
What are you obsessed about the most in the company? That's a good question to ask.
Culture, I feel, just what I obsess about most in our company is people showing respect to each other.
Okay.
Right? I think it all, see, at some level, we don't have plants, machinery, right?
Mm.
It's not like a machine you bought, you press a button, it works the same way, irrespective of whether you scream at it, shout at it, or love it. Our type of companies depend on the people completely. Yeah. Like our success, failure, everything is dependent on the people.
Yeah.
So then you would want to make sure that they have a very safe environment, right? And safe environment is not just physical safety, it's also emotionally safe environment.
Yep.
And actually that begins with just having basic respect, right?
True.
And mutual respect.
So do you cautiously like take step or like do something where you make sure that everybody's respecting everybody? Because, you know, sometimes at different levels, a lot of people come from different pedigrees.
Mm.
So when they join a new company, they have this pedigree. Okay, I am this person. So everybody.
Yeah, we don't care.
You don't care.
Yeah. I think you could be whoever. It doesn't matter.
Mm.
Like.
So do you consciously do something? Ki nahi? Ki day one pe, like they understand that everybody is working in the same way. So they have to.
I think if you don't figure it within the first few days, the problem is not with the organization. Because we are so homogeneous as a company when it comes to things like empathy, respect, that you'll just feel it on day one, right? Mm. Like you're here in our office, right? You'll be here for 2 hours, you'll also feel it. So it's not to do with, I don't think if HR has to come tell you on your induction day that please be respectful, it's not going to work.
Yeah.
Right? It's just going to bounce off you. You have to experience how people are treating each other in the office. That's what makes you imbibe the same feelings.
You know, I have a question on this, and then we can dive into like some really cool topics. So I was listening to one of these interviews by Mark Zuckerberg. Okay. So Mark Zuckerberg says that every idea is a $1 billion idea. Okay. But which execution may the idea which is going to become a $1 billion only depends on the amount of good people are joining you.
Hmm.
because one person cannot build it. So it's like the number of good people join you actually decides how fast or slow you're going to reach there.
Yeah.
So it's very crucial when you hire. So when you were hiring at the initial stage, like day one, you thought, okay, I'm going to start this.
Mm.
And then you decided, okay, I'm going to hire my top five people.
Mm.
So what were you thinking? Like, what were the, let's say, three or four things in your mind that these are the potential traits or characters or knowledge or skills which I'm going to hire for?
Hmm. You know, the first few people you hire as a company are not your top people in the classic sense.
Okay.
They are the people you need to get a job done.
Hmm.
And you're very clear in your mind what the jobs are, okay, right, to be done. These are things that likely you have been doing or you don't know how to do. It's one of those. And when you hire someone, you do, it's a very task-oriented hire. So in the early stages, it's not about seniority or top people or CXOs. Rarely anyone hires at that level in the beginning. But one of the things we used to do and we continue to do as a company, which has worked really, really well for us, is in any position which is mid-management and mid-level and up, they have to make a presentation about the role that they are coming in for, where we only give them a few bullet points that you are going to be in this role. How are you going to do these 3, 4, 5, 6 things? So basis any publicly available information about the company, prepare your thoughts. One thing we noticed is it did a few things following that process. One, it automatically weeded out people who didn't have humility. Because many times we would run into folks who say, mere se kaise pooch liya presentation banane ke liye? Have they not seen my CV?
Yeah.
You know where I went to college? You know where I work? So while we care about those things, we care more about you being a humble person, where you should be open to the fact that you may not know everything, because nobody knows everything.
Yeah.
And so automatically folks who are not humble, I would say, or intellectually humble, get weeded out, because we've always been uncompromising about this requirement. Mm. Uncompromising. It also ensures there's some homogeneity because everyone knows that anyone who's in the company has gone through that process.
Yeah.
Right. So it's very equitable in that way. And then finally, what it did was ensure that we could understand that when someone was given a blank slate, could they actually have structure around it? Could they actually think out of the box? Because when folks work in a very set environment where someone, they have had predecessors doing the same job and they've created the template of how to do that job, there are many people who are excellent at it.
Yep.
However, when they're given a completely clean canvas, can they actually paint the canvas the first time themselves? And that's what we would always figure out through this process. And in the last, forever, since we started the company, we've never deviated from following this process.
Oh, that's a good, that's a deal breaker for you. It's like humility and everything else. Okay, one following question, because I feel this is a personal problem. So it's like a personal question. When you hire people, okay, in the beginning, and everything's going right, and one day you feel okay, now you guys are not aligning, and there's a time to let that person go. How do you fire? How do you decide that? How do you have that hard conversation that, dude, I respect you and I know that you are a good person. Let's say you will be doing good, but we don't fit right now.
Yeah.
So you need to go. How do you fire? How do you make sure that this is not the right place now?
Yeah, I feel
how do you have
it's the toughest thing. I think anyone who runs any kind of business, founder or not a founder, right? Yeah. Every manager who's ever managed people likely has had to do that. And it's the most unfortunate and unsavory part of managing people, right? Or running a business. But at least, what we've always seen is that the conversation becomes easier if there is no negative surprise attached to it. It's a hard conversation for both sides, right? Let's not get that wrong. It is tough for both sides and tougher for the impacted party. Yeah. There's no doubt about it. However, one can make it a little easier, make the landing a bit softer, by making sure it's not a negative surprise. That happens more often than we think.
So negative surprise, as in like, can you go deeper
on this? You just suddenly call someone to your room and say,
bye.
Today's your last day, right? Or tomorrow's your last day.
Ah.
Never, ever, ever do that. almost everyone, when you feel that you're not going to be working with a person anymore, chances are very bright that you've known that for a while.
Yeah.
Right? So why are you holding it back? Right? I would say there has to be a time and a grace period you have to give people to say, hey, you know, I feel there's a disconnect in terms of the expectations and the delivery. Why don't you take another 3 months and I'm happy to help you come up to speed. But then enough time passes and enough leeway has been given and still things don't come through. I think it's important to just very naturally make it clear to the person that there is not going to be a future at the company versus making it a very sudden surprise so that they also have the time to find something
explore
else.
More
I mean, people have families, they have children, they have parents to support, they need medical insurance. You can't do that to people.
Yeah.
You can't just suddenly do that. You have to take care of. Now, there are extraneous circumstances where companies need to do that. But even then, you can be gracious.
Yeah.
Right? But those are usually extraneous circumstances. Usually happen once in a company's lifetime. But for the most part, one can't be so unemotional and tactical about it.
So it's like set right expectation setting and then keep nudging them for a long time so that they are also prepared that, hey, if I don't turn this thing around, probably I'll also have to look for something else.
Yep.
So that's a good one because, so, you know, I read like a lot of business people and how they have built businesses. So I've often heard it from a lot of people that hey, hire fast, fire faster. And I used to believe in this as well. Like, let's do this. But as the company started growing and earlier, like I was working with kids, like my age people, like 20, 21, 22. So it was very easier to like tell them, hey, bye. But now that I have people who have families, 35, 40, 42, it's so difficult. Like the fire faster doesn't work.
Like I don't think it ever works.
Yeah, it doesn't work.
I don't think it ever works, Raj. I feel it has a indelible and perpetual negative impact on the culture you're building.
Okay.
Right? Where no one in the company will ever trust the leaders of a company like that. Because they'll always be watching over their shoulder that, am I next? You cannot create a great business, a great company, or create impact. It's not also about how large a business you build. Like any organization could be a not-for-profit also, right? It doesn't have to be like a startup and, you know, things that are in vogue. Any kind of organization where people have to come together for a common purpose, they need to feel respected. They need to feel that their voice matters. They need to feel safe that, you know, sudden decisions won't get taken that impact them very personally, right? And if you take these surprises out of the equation, then people become far more open and transparent with each other also. And they work a lot better with each other that way. So I've never really this hire fast, fire fast. I think it's complete nonsense.
It's not that. Okay. The fair way of seeing things. And I think it does make sense.
Invest the time before hiring, right?
Like, yeah. I was just going to say this.
Yeah. I mean, people don't do the lazy stuff of just hire quickly and then see, okay, we'll push all of these guys through a sieve. Whoever, you know, makes it. Like, this is not how cultures are built.
No, it's interesting, you know. Well, let's switch the conversation and talk about a lot of people know you for Snapdeal, but a lot of people don't know that you are an avid angel investor. And early age investor is the right word, I would say.
Early stage,
Early stage investor who has invested now in more than 300 companies?
Yeah.
Or more?
Yeah, about 300.
300 companies. And when did you start?
We started 11 years ago.
Okay.
Right? So 2011.
I want to know about the first investing happened. Like, okay, first tell me the conversation. What is early age investing?
Yeah, early stage investing is essentially, you know, the way I think about it is first money into the company.
Okay.
Right? This is when it's basically
idea stage.
Yeah, just one or two or three co-founders just came together and they are thinking what they want to do. They have an early idea. They may have some prototype. They may have some just wireframes. Mm-hmm. Or they may just have a presentation. Right. In some cases, they may just have a one-page write-up.
Yeah.
It could be Like usually pre-revenue businesses. And early stage investing is arguably the most important part of the startup ecosystem.
Okay.
Because unless someone provides this high belief capital, at that point in time when there is no proof point whatsoever, the egg only will not hatch.
Yeah.
Right? And then the subsequent rounds of financing, which venture capital and private equity firms do, they'll never come to fruition.
True.
Right? So at least we've been very focused and we really enjoy partnering with founders just when they are starting, when they're really at the idea stage. Because it's almost like giving birth, right? Like, see, as founders and operators ourselves, we can only be involved with one business in an operating capacity. But, you know, most founders have this kira, right? That, you know, about ideas and, you know, things that they can do. But if you have to do something really well, you can largely only run one business.
Yeah.
Right? Really well. However, vicariously, indirectly, you can get the joy of being involved in other industries, other types of businesses. So that's what we enjoy. And also, you know, 11 years ago, Raj, there wasn't much of this early stage.
Startup culture was not there much. So
I mean, I remember when we started in 2007, this word startup was also not known, right? Like it was mostly, you know, if you didn't get a job, that's why you must be doing this, right? It was almost like adverse selection.
Okay.
That these guys probably weren't good enough to get a job, even though they went to decent colleges. So hence, they are doing their own thing.
It's not cool enough.
Yeah, it was unlike now, where if you're not doing a startup, right, there is a problem. Like, are you not smart enough? Are you not creative enough? Are you not risk-taking? People will ask all those type of questions. Ki bhai, tu itna smart hai. Why are you not doing a startup? Or at least why are you not working at a startup? Right? Neither was happening back then.
Yeah.
But I think we've just, you know, people ask me what has changed in the last 15 years. I always say, like, what has not changed in India when it comes to the startup ecosystem?
So 11 years ago, that was like 2011. So in 2011, you did your first early age investing. Which was the first company?
Ola.
Okay. Oh, nice.
Yeah, so...
And what made you decide that, hey, let me put in?
Look, I think people will obviously always explain their investments by expressing how brilliant they were in identifying this huge opportunity around shared mobility. I will not claim any such thing.
Okay.
I remember I was at a conference and... Yeah, I was walking out of the conference and there is this young guy with a backpack standing in the somewhere on the side and just said, "Hi, Kunal." I said, "Hi." And then he said, "I just want to have a quick chat with you." I'm like, "Sure, I have some time." So we just sat on a sofa on the side and he started telling me about what they were doing and that, you know, they wanted to do intercity mobility. Mm-hmm. And then they were also testing intra-city mobility. But still very early days, 5-10 rides a day probably. And that was Bhavish. And I was very clear in my mind that this is something, this is someone we would want to be involved with, right?
Like,
it was just so outstanding. You could see the fire in his eyes, right? In the classic sense. And so we were very clear that we would love to partner with him and, you know, credit to him. He got us involved in the business in his first round that he raised. That was our first one. But then subsequently every year, what happened slowly, a few founders would start reaching out to us through references, through LinkedIn, etc. And we would make investments in a few companies. And then by around 2015, this sort of snowballed a little bit where we were getting so many inbounds that we didn't even have the time to look at everything and respond to everyone. And we realized that we either have to stop investing because it's, you know, not good on our part to not even be able to respond.
Yeah.
Or we have to do it a little properly, right? Institutionalize it, etc. which is what we did around 2015-16. And after that, it kind of took a life of its own. I think every year now, about 4,000 companies reach out to Titan Capital for funding.
Oh, wow. And it's early stage.
Only early stage.
Okay, so here's a question. What do you see in a founder? Like, what are the, let's say, top three things you see in a founder? Because it's very difficult to identify someone in just one conversation. So I'm sure, like, you must have, like, you know, developed your own gut feeling around it. Because at the end of the day, it's gut.
Yeah.
So, because pre-state, so there's no numbers to look at.
Yeah.
It's just, so what is, like, what are the top three things you look at in a founder?
Yeah, I would say in a company. See, I feel, you know, good judgment comes with experience.
Yeah.
And experience comes with bad judgment.
Okay.
So having exercise good amount of bad judgment through the years, one does get some good experiences so that you can then exercise good judgment.
Yeah.
And I think it's no different.
Did you have like, do you want to talk about any one company which you felt like was a bad judgment at the start at least or something?
I consider any such events as just learning experiences. Okay. So I don't necessarily hold anything against
okay.
Life is too short. Right? Oh. You have to keep moving forward. But I feel in companies, when we assess companies, we're not sector focused, etc., quite sector agnostic. But like we've done everything from consumer internet to SaaS to deep tech to, you know, fintech, etc., consumer products, etc. But what is very important is that the founder should be really obsessed about like a single problem statement, at least at that early stage. Over a period of time, the problem statements may expand.
Okay.
But in the early stages, they have to be like acutely obsessed about one large problem statement. Like they just have to be like thinking about it in the shower all day long that's very important. So that for us is a deal breaker. If someone shows up, I have five ideas. By the way, we were like that when we started. We had like five ideas.
Yeah.
And then one investor we met told us that, do you think any one of these ideas will become a big company? We said, yes, all five. He said, just pick one of them then. So I think it's from personal lessons also. But there are three things we largely look for in companies that we would meet. One is obviously the team.
Okay.
Now, have they demonstrated some amount of success, some proof point academically, professionally?
So, okay. Here's a question on this only, that how do you identify a team? Because in the beginning, there's no team, right?
Like team as in founders.
Okay. Yeah, two, three people.
Team,
the first.
Team, I mean, founding team.
All right.
The broader team, I don't think investors generally meet anyways. Okay. Plus, there isn't much.
Mm-hmm.
Mostly when we invest, there are a few interns outside of the founders. So there's not nobody else to meet.
Got it.
So but yeah, but they, just, you know, are these folks who, can I visualize few years out, they're standing in front of a 500-person team and can they continue to
lead,
inspire them? Right? Do they have that charisma to inspire them? Doesn't mean they're great orators.
Yeah.
But do they have that fire around the purpose that they are so deeply embedded in to inspire hundreds of other people to work with them? Because, you know, building a startup requires you to instill people with great hope.
Yes.
Right? So that's very critical. I would say the other thing is just the size of the opportunity, right, needs to be substantial. It can't be some really small, modest idea. I'm not saying those businesses shouldn't be built, but then you don't need us to be involved in that company.
True.
Right? Because we want to be involved in like market-changing businesses, right? Whether they end up succeeding or not is a different thing. But the starting point, they should have that type of ambition. And you know, the best founders actually have the ability to get investors to gaze into this crystal ball with them, right? Where they'll mesmerize you with what this can become in the future.
Yeah.
And I just really cherish those moments when I get to do that. Third would be the ability to generate unit economics for the business, right? Mm. So, you know, the unit economics of the business, which is essentially your ability to make some margin on whatever you're selling, whether it's a product or a service or a technology, whatever it is so critical because that defines the soul of the business, right? Whether it's a squirrel with a tail or elephant with a trunk is determined by the unit economics of the business. It also determines how the company acts day to day, how the founder thinks every day, how do they think about costs, how do they think about revenues, how do they think about which target audience they're going after. So unit economics are actually a very important part. And by the way, there's almost no revenue and no unit economics to show when we invest, okay, right? But at least we would like the founder to have a point of view. That what is it going to be a 10% margin business or is it going to be a 50% margin business? Because many times founders will say it's 10% today, but it'll become 50%. Mm. I tell them it will become 50%, but it'll also be a different business.
Yeah.
Right? So you can't go from a 10% business to a 50% business and yet be in the same business. So some of these choices, it's like when you're firing a rocket, these are that initial trajectory of the rocket. This is that. Because you can 10% trajectory will take you to Mars.
Yeah.
And the 50% will take you to, outside our solar system.
Nice. It's a very, so I'm starting my, I'm building a new startup and I'm thinking about, you kind of cleared a lot of stuff for me and gave me a framework to work on. So I want to just repeat it to summarize. First, ground zero is a founder needs to be obsessed about one problem, because as young people trying to do something, I can totally relate to it that I have 10 things to work on and be like, har kisi mein opportunity hai, sab bada ban jayega, kisi ek mein mere sath koi ho jaye to sab bada bana denge, right? So we need to eradicate that and then come up with one. That's a foundation. Then back on that, first thing is you need to develop a personality, because your personality is going to drive the culture around the company, and that is very important, because are you that person who has this ability to, mesmerize or inspire people at constant level? Because initially for the first 5 years, nobody's going to believe you anyway. So can you do that? That's first. Second is the opportunity in the market. How big is the market? Are you going for a vitamins market or an aspirin market? You need to figure that out. And third is you need to, from day one, have a point of view of how you're going to justify your CAC in terms of LTV, right? That's essentially
yeah.
it.
Yeah.
That's
yeah.
what we talked about.
Yeah.
Nice. So this makes a lot of sense, and it's a very good framework to start with. When did you when you started, did you get any of your early age investor? Who was the first early age investor who invested?
Yeah, I think our first investor is a fun story. It became quite viral on social media a few months ago. I wrote about it. And our first investor was actually someone who's many years my senior. He was a very senior Microsoft executive. He was he was much senior to me. So he had graduated from my program at my college many years, 25 years before or 20 plus years before I did. And I stayed in touch with him because he had come to give a lecture at our college, and I stayed in touch with him. Then I was working at Microsoft for a year. And then Microsoft had actually applied for my H-1B visa, which got rejected.
Okay.
So I was asked to leave the US.
Okay.
Right. And that's how I actually came back to India to start our company. And I remember I used to go for lunch once a quarter with Ken. His name is Ken Glass. I used to meet him for lunch at a Thai restaurant near the Microsoft campus. And my final lunch with him, we finished the lunch and I tell him, Ken, I have some bad news. I'm going to be leaving the US in a couple of weeks. And he was shocked to hear that my visa was rejected. And so he said, so what's the plan? So what are you going to do once you go back to India? I said, look, I'm going to start this coupon book business, which is how we had started when we started the company. And he didn't really spend much time asking about the business model, etc. He just said one thing. He said, let me know if you need any help. Right. I was all of 23. I didn't really understand what does that. I was like, this tech executive in Seattle, how will he help me? He's never been to India also.
Yeah.
So I was like, sure. Thanks for your wishes. And we went our separate ways. I think when I came back to India, within 3 months, Rohit and I realized that, we had put in 100% of our savings, whatever. He had worked for 1 year at Capital One. I had worked for 1 year at Microsoft. We had put our 100% of whatever money we had saved into the company. And we realized it's not going to last very long. Mm-hmm. That's when he realized that actually we'll need some external money. I think we were so naive at that time. Yeah. Now everyone knows, right? Like, yeah, you need capital, angel investor, seed investor. We had no, there's no ecosystem to teach you those things. So then suddenly I had a, you know, epiphany. I was like, you know, maybe I should call Ken. He said he wanted to help. So I don't know what that means. Maybe just advice, maybe capital. Let's ask. So I called up Ken. I said, Ken, this is what we are doing. We're putting in everything we have in this, but we need more money. Can you help? And he said, sure. How much? And I said, I don't know. Like, he said, okay, I'll give you $100,000. And literally in 2 minutes, the conversation was done. And that's how it started. You know, Ken came to the came to India for the first time for my wedding in 2012. That was the first time he came. So imagine this gentleman who lives in Seattle, never been to India, has met me all of 5-6 times in his life, wrote a check all the way from there, right? I mean, it just shows that there are good people in this world who are true believers and want other young people to succeed. And he continues to be an investor, right? 15 years later.
Okay. Yeah. What kind of founder should raise funds? And what kind of founder should not? Like, is it, do you advise that everybody who's trying to start out, they need to put their entire life saving and emergency fund and everything into one company? And then when they run out, then they reach out to investors? Or from day one, even if they have savings, they can go out and raise external capital without putting their own capital?
Look, I think it's a very personal decision. Everyone's situation, personal situation is a bit different. So I don't want to give like generic gyan that, you know, that sab laga do. Right? Like, I think that's maybe being unempathetic to people's respective situations. I feel when companies start, they need a certain amount of, like, modest amount of capital just to get out of the door. Right, which is hire the first few interns, get a small office space, get an internet connection, buy a few laptops, buy some software licenses. Mm-hmm. It all adds up, right? It doesn't go into many crores or rupees, but it can easily run into tens of lakhs, right? And not everyone has that money lying around, right? Or even if they have, they may not have just the you know, conviction yet to put all of that in. Now, we've often seen founders put some of it from their, you know, family or their own savings, and some they raise. I feel capital at that stage, almost everyone needs. Right? Yeah. That's really where we come in. After that, founders need capital to scale. And that's where a clear decision is presented to them, where capital is almost inversely correlated with patience. Okay. Right? If you're willing to be very patient, then you likely don't need
External capital,
because external capital to scale up is usually is front loaded to accelerate your growth. You know, first time founders, myself included, we are like, just want to go, right? We we don't want to wait for anything, right? Like, that's the high, right? Like, we want to go for it, want to move fast,
disrupt.
Yeah, you know, disrupt. Like, even our teams get a high out of that, right? So I totally relate to that. I understand that. If the founder is okay with it, comes with a lot of dilution. And maybe as a first-time founder, many first-time founders are okay with it.
Yeah.
Because it's their first time, right? They're getting this great opportunity to, you know, realize their dream.
Yeah.
So they're okay with dilution because they're like, hey, I have zero anyways right now. Right? So, okay, I'll have 5%, 10% of something really large. It's better than zero today. And I get to realize my dream. However, there are founders who will say that, no, I want to build it patiently. I want to own all or most of it. And there are two very fundamental ways of building a company. There is no right or wrong answer. I know sometimes a lot of this capital raising and capital burning is vilified, especially in current environment. But look, a lot of great businesses were built by raising external capital, right? I'm not even counting the current cohort of companies, but the Apples and the Googles and the Amazons, everything, they all raise money in a different era and different quantums. But it's a very personal choice, the way I see it. And it has a high correlation to being either being impatient and not in a bad way, or being patient.
So it has to be driven out of A, the market opportunity you're going forward to, and B, the personality you have.
However, there are some types of businesses which you can't run without external capital. Let's say you're doing a biotech startup or a deep tech startup where revenue is maybe years out. But that business needs to be built because you are passionate about it and the world needs it. There you may not have a choice. Even though you're willing to be patient, where the first product comes out 4 years later, but you will still need the capital to sustain until then.
Even the network effect apps and like tech, like social networks and everything, they need like a lot of capital initially to build their user base. And then one day maybe they'll be able to make money.
That's what we are all made to believe. Okay. But I think because most of these businesses in the world of tech have been built by, you know, smart, aggressive, impatient people, because they're impatient for success, impatient for progress, impatient for growth. Hence, we don't know whether these businesses can be built
without it. True.
So what we don't know, we don't know. But you're right about what we know.
Yeah. And it's so most of the time, everything is driven out of role models, right? So what you value is something you get influenced by. So everybody is seeing the celebrations around. Everybody, these stories are out. Everyone's like looking at, let's say, the Jobs and the Zuckerbergs of the world. And that's why everyone's like, okay, we need to raise funds. We need to go public. We need to do this. We need to do that. Because that's the only role model we have in front of us.
Yeah.
Anyone who's going to change that, probably people will start following that as well. The early age investing is a very lucrative way to wealth creation as well. And I wanted to point that out. Like, when you do early age investing, right? I'm sure like when you were doing only for the fun of it, the passion and supporting founders, there would have been a different why. But now that you're a titan, do you think the why is wealth creation as well?
Firstly, I think we are very different from a typical fund because we don't have any external capital.
Oh.
We only invest our own capital.
Oh.
So our we have tremendous ability to be, you know, invest as much as we like, invest as little as we like, stay invested for as long as we like or as little as we like, right? Our bias is to, as I said, be the first money in, but then stay invested for 10 to 15 years.
Okay.
90% of the companies we have invested in, we are still investors in, right, over the last 11 years. So, I mean, because our view is companies take a long time to get built, especially in India, where the ecosystem truly really took off after 2017-18, once Jio came in and the 4G revolution happened. And we feel that we want to be partners with the founders, literally into for perpetuity, maybe till when they become a public company, we would consider exiting. But our bias is always to stay invested.
Okay.
Right. And so we are a little different, I would say. And I think founders like that about us because, you know, we are voting with our own conviction because 100% of what we invest is our own capital, right? Always. And, but I do feel that, you know, oftentimes these don't work as well. And we are always led to believe that, you know, this early stage investing is like a lottery ticket, right? And a lottery ticket to great riches and whatnot. You know, the success rate is abysmally low. It's very, very low.
Okay.
It is some would call it the riskiest asset class out there.
Okay.
Right? I think of it as, you know, investing and partnering behind these really talented dreamers. But it is very risky. There is no doubt. And there will be many, many that don't work.
So, but it has become very cool these days. Like everybody's becoming an angel investor.
It's the it's the ultimate flex.
Oh.
Right? These days for a lot of people, you know, I guess it used to be maybe a iPhone or it used to be a car or a...
Now angel investing.
Now it's angel investor.
Oh, I'm an angel investor.
Yeah.
So, I started investing as an angel and... like, who am I? Like, I'm nobody. Has just started. It's like, and I've done it like 22 companies in last 1 year.
It's a lot.
Okay. So my mindset was, so when I was starting to doing this, we do a lot of brand deals, right? So, and we were doing these brand deals with startups. So I was like, guys, instead of paying me, let's say 50 lakhs, let's do one thing that you give me like 20 lakh cash, 30 lakh, you give me in equity, because then this gives me an opportunity to have more money in future. Because what am I going to do? For my expenses, I only need 1 lakh.
Yeah.
Anyway, I don't need. So you're giving me 20. So rest 30, it's better that you give it that way. So it started like that. So first 7, 8 were like that. Then we were like, hey, can we do this completely in terms of buying a space? So you get like an ad space in my podcast, in my, like you get a media space and I get equity in your company. So it built like that. But then after like 10 or 12, I was like, because, you know, when we're starting in 6 months, few of those company, they raised another round at a 3x valuation or the 5x valuation. So I thought like, it's very lucrative. Let me do it more often. Okay. And then like the last 8 or 7, which I did, it was only with the view of this gives an immense opportunity for me to create wealth for myself. But is this the right way of thinking of creating wealth? Or do you think that people who don't have an expertise and who don't understand it in depth as much as, let's say, you understand, should stay away from it and put it in safe, like mutual fund mein lagao, thoda thoda badh jayega?
It's a good question. And again, I'm not an investment advisor, so I can't really give investment advice to people. And everyone has a different skill set, etc. See, at least I feel that one should not measure success of investing in these early stage companies by how much the next round was marked up or the next to next round was marked up. The key is to believe that are the companies that you've invested in building lasting, enduring businesses or not. And that usually becomes clearer year 4, 5, 6 versus when you invested or when the company started. What happens generally in year 1 or 2 is inconsequential, because even at that time, year 1, 2, 3, everyone is still hoping that something will happen. So, and all the markups, etc., generally happen keeping that in mind, right? Not because necessarily great value has already been built. Great promise has been built, but not necessarily great value has been built. And hence, I think one should only enter investing at these early stages if you have the staying power to stay invested for a decade, right? Only then will you truly understand whether you pick the right companies and the right founders or not. You know, I do feel, though, that angel investing or seed stage investing or investor of any kind, like I said, should not be seen as a lottery ticket. It's actually a lot of responsibility when done right. Right?
Like a lot of family offices want to do this now.
Yeah, everyone wants to do it. Right? Yeah. Like, I feel that's a great thing. You know, lots more capital at the early stages for founders means we'll have more startups. Like, hamara desh to aise hi batlega na.
Yeah.
Like, we don't need more policies necessarily, right? Like, we need more founders. We need more founders, more startups to solve the umpteen challenges and opportunities that exist around us in our country. And make us proud by even selling their products and services overseas, right? But I feel that investors have to decide, right? Where do they want to play? In terms of, do they want to be very involved, but then you can't be overbearing? Or do you want to be uninvolved, but then you can't also be unavailable when the founder needs you? You have to strike a balance. Like, which end of the spectrum do you want to be on? But then you can't be on the absolute ends also. Right, you can't just fill it, shut it, forget it. Okay. Right, because
nice. So, okay, when does the exit happen in these angel in the startups investing and early age investing? Let's say a family office is watching this and they want to start investing and they want to see it as a wealth creation, and then they also want to see it as that they can help us in certain way. But how does the exit happen? Like, when does it happen? You stay invested forever, or is there like you have a liquidation preference, like, or
yeah,
you
so
have like stage three, I get out. What is it?
Yeah, as I said, we are a bit atypical, right? I think when there are funds, they have a certain finite life because they've taken money from limited partners, from other investors, and they have a certain investing period and a certain exit period, and then the fund closes. Generally, is 10 years, give or take. So I think funds are a little more regimented about these things as to when they enter, when they exit. We are, as I said, a little more evergreen that way, that we would love to stay invested perpetually.
Forever.
Now, that said, there are situations where we need to exit because the company itself has gone through an M&A event where we have to sell our shares to the buyer of the company. Or in some cases, a company may be going public and we need to sell our shares as part of that transaction. So there are specific events when that may happen. But our bias has always been to stay invested.
So that's your buyer, but someone who is investing, and from your experience, what options do they have to get there?
Yeah, so I think one is they either you can sell your shares to an incoming investor in a future round.
Okay.
Obviously, if the company goes through an M&A event, you can sell your shares as part of that. Or you can wait for an IPO to happen. That's usually the three options. And honestly, none of those are in the investor's control.
Mm-hmm.
So I think investors should not get into this by thinking that they can, it's like a mutual fund or a public equity that they're holding that, you know, they can sell it at will. These are highly illiquid, illiquid, right? And so unless you have the staying power to stay invested for a long period of time,
don't put in
because it will ruin your reputation and ruin your relationship with the founder. If you start hustling the founder that, you know, I need an exit. It's been 3 years. Mm-hmm. I need an exit right now. Because the founder usually can't do much about it. He'll just say, or she will just say, look, whenever the next financing round happens, it's 3 months out or 3 years out, I will try and make it happen, but I can't promise you. And that sensitivity any investor should have when they're investing in startups.
Yeah, and if anyone's entering with certain mindscape, it can ruin a lot of things. Like the relationship, the financial relationship, a lot of everything. That's insane. So you talked about that every founder should have somebody who they can go to and be very, really candid about things.
Yeah.
You've had people, they have like really been candid about you. With you about situations. So can you point out any situation? Like, don't take the name. Means be like, the most candid conversation you've had with the founder. The founder came to you and be like, boss, ab ye ho gaya, ab karna kya hai?
Yeah, I think mostly I feel founders reach out to me for two things. If I were to just look at last 11 years, either they want an introduction to someone or, something's hit the fan.
Okay.
And
give me an example of something like this was really candid with somebody. I'll give you an example, right? One of the podcasts I was having, and this guy was an angel investor, this entrepreneur, and he invested in some company where they got raided by XYZ department. And the founder is like middle of night calls this guy. He's like, I've gotten raided. I don't know what to do next. Can you please help? And this guy, like, he was like, main vacation pe jaane wala tha, aadhi raat mein chhod ke uske paas gaya.
Yeah, look, I think almost anything that you think can go wrong does go wrong in a startup's journey, right?
Like,
you have to deal, as a founder, you have to deal with things almost on a day-to-day basis that you never dealt with.
Mm-hmm.
You don't have a framework in your mind how to deal with them. And that's where people like us come in, because we've gone through the same thing and we figured out how to deal with many, many situations of various kinds. See, my only always ask of founders is just don't do something that will bring shame to you and your family, right? Like, don't do something wrong, right? Outside of that, almost every other problem that you will face
solvable.
In the business will be solvable with some amount of pain, likely, but it's solvable, right? Like, it will be solvable. But, you know, I feel that one of the things I've seen a few times now over the last 11 years is being the intermediator between either co-founders not getting along or intermediator between founders and investors not getting along. So I'm usually,
intermediator
brought in. I would say that has happened more often than probably anything else. I think everything else is a little more tactical and does happen from time to time. And we help to the best of our abilities. But this one is complicated, right?
Yeah.
Like, this one's very, it's personalities, it's context, it's, he said, she said, you said. And being able to bring people together, be cordial with each other, problem solve with the greater purpose of the business has been so critical, at least as a role that I've had to play.
So what's the, let's say, now I'm giving you a situation. What's the first thing in your mind? Like, what do you do is you're close with an investor, you're close with a founder. They both now hate each other because they're like, fuck you, I don't want to work with this guy. This guy's not helping me out. This is, and you go and like, guys, we need to make this work because you both are incredible people. It's just one thing which ever gone wrong, right? So how do you make, like, what's your approach? As a, this is like, I'm asking from a point of view of psychology. Like, how do you cool down like two extremely powerful parties who have their own egos and personalities?
Yeah, I think the key is to check those out at the door as a first step. So, you know, first and foremost, in such a situation, I would talk to both independently, right? Really understand what the concerns
listening
are.
Is first.
Yeah, just listen. Just listen. Let them. Because nobody's been listening to them. That's the biggest issue. They've been trying to say something that they feel makes a lot of sense, but nobody's listening to them.
Hmm.
So I'm like, okay, I'll listen. Let me be the sponge. Okay. Right? And because I feel it's a shame where companies go down because a couple of people didn't get along. And it happens more often than you'd imagine. Right? It happens when people stop respecting each other, when people stop listening to each other, when neither of the two are putting the effort to come on the same page, right? And are just enforcing their respective views on the other person. So I would spend some time with each of them separately. And then I would say, let's now meet together. And I've seen that, you know, there's this Airtel ad many years ago when I was a kid. There was this India-Pakistan, or possibly India-Pakistan border, and two kids are playing football and, you know, they become friends over football. And the tagline was, you know, barriers break when people talk. It was a fantastic line for a telecom company. So I think credit to them. And I've seen that over and over again, right? Like when barriers really break when people talk. The problem is when people stop talking and stop listening to each other.
So it's true that when people stop listening and start assuming, that's where most of the things go wrong. Whether it's your personal relationship, company relationship, business relationship, any kind of relationship. Like it's just assumption kills you when you're... Because you have certain factors or certain things which has influenced you to think about a X person in a certain way.
Yeah.
And you've just started assuming.
Yeah.
So you need that one person in the middle and be like, hey, you know what?
All chasms begin with a fissure. Right? Every... like big gap between people starts with a very small hairline crack, right? And it happens in the best of relationships, in personal and professional lives. But you got to tape it up right there.
So, okay, here's a question. Like what, because you've worked with companies and sectors across, right? There are failures and there are successes. Okay. Why does a company become successful? Like what does it have in them? What's the deal breaker for a successful company? Like, what do you think? Like, I'm sure it's a mixture of 1,000 things and there's no right or wrong formula for it. But what are the top three things which you feel that every company has it that makes them great?
It's very hard.
Or every startup.
Yeah, I think at different stages, maybe the answer becomes a little different. But I would say a couple of things that tend to be quite pervasive in successful companies is, you know, a great sense of purpose, right? That is very important. If you don't have purpose that binds the entire company, over a period of time, you'll see people just, you know, drifting apart, right? Because you can't just motivate people with, you know, revenue target, profit target, growth target. You can't, right? There has to be some broader purpose that why do we show up every day in this space to work together, right? And I think, look, purposes tend to evolve. It's not like, you know...
Yeah, day one purpose is going to be different.
That's what I said, that at different stages, it could be different. But at a point in time, there has to be a purpose that's the glue that binds everyone together. I have a strong view on the role of culture in companies. Some companies pride themselves in saying, look, we have the most innovative culture, right? Some companies say we have the most respectful or empathetic culture, and so on and so forth. So knowing what is your culture, right, is very important, and having one. Right? I think you said it well that, you know, no culture is sort of the worst thing, right? I think you have to decide what is your culture, and obviously a positive, something that has some positive attributes to it. And then investing behind it day to day, through, not through words, because words are cheap, right? But through your actions as leaders and across the company. At any level in the company, everyone has to exhibit that culture every day they show up to work. And then finally, I would say is transparency. I would say the best companies, at least I have seen, are incredibly transparent companies, particularly internally, where they are always sharing on an ongoing basis what's going well and what's not going well.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, sometimes leaders can feel a bit scared or insecure sharing the bad news, right? While they may be celebrating the good news every time, right? So there has to be this balance between, you know, just being transparent about not being too euphoric when things are great and not being too despondent when things are not.
Mm-hmm.
And having this equilibrium mindset, and that comes with just, and being very transparent about that equilibrium mindset in the company, and about what is going well and what is not. I would say these are three broad attributes. Now, you know, every company is different, and I'm sure enough examples can be painted about very successful companies that don't exhibit these three.
See, you run a consumer facing company, and you, I'm sure, like hundreds of people you have met, right? What have you understood about Indian customers or Indian consumers? Like, how are they different from the rest of the world? Because you've worked at Microsoft, so you understand the US market a bit and Indian market a bit.
Yeah, I think...
How is India different than US?
Question I ask is it? Right? There is always this... People try to say, you know, Indian consumers are very different.
Hmm.
I always ask, are they really? Right? Every consumer wants value.
Hmm.
Right? Yeah, there's always that, you know, small segment that probably is completely agnostic to what things cost and whether they are value for money or not. But my experience tells me that consumers seek value for money anywhere in the world.
Yeah.
Now, they may just have higher propensity to pay because of where they live, because the per capita GDP would be higher. I'm yet to hear cogent examples. People say this all the time. Indian consumers are different, right? But I've never heard a cogent example of how, right? Consumers everywhere are the same. They all want good products. They want good prices. They want good service. They want to be treated in a respectful manner. They want to purchase products or services from companies they consider are trustworthy. They want to deal with people they consider are good and trustworthy. So I don't understand, like, why would...
Everybody would talk. So let me give you an example, because I ask this question a lot. When you look at Western market, right? The loyalty towards the brand is very high versus when you do it in India. Because a lot of things there are built on emotions, because their security is being taken care of. So their basic, let's say, their social security, their healthcare, their education, the education of the kids, everything security has been done. That's why these guys are more loyal towards the brands who care for them. Whereas in India, because of the security is not that strong. Like, I mean, I often joke about this, that for security, we have to even pay to our security guard in the building, right? Forget social security, right? So because of the security is not sure. That's why we are less loyal towards brand and more loyal towards our pocket. Like, we want to save it. Even if there's a brand which I absolutely love, but if the same kind of product, or let's say even a similar product, someone else is offering me at a 5% discount, I would shift on that, because I care more about my product than my emotions. So do you feel that it's different in India?
While that may be true in pockets, I don't think our country would have so many large, enduring, successful brands if consumers were not loyal, right? Mm. Because there is always, chances are, if you go to your kitchen in your house, I can tell you that 8 out of 10 brands in your kitchen would be the same over the last decade, maybe 2 decades, maybe even 3 decades, right? People are loyal not only to consumer product brands, they're also loyal to political parties, right? They, you know, so there is loyalty there too. There is loyalty all around us. I think the question brands have to ask is, are we giving enough reason for the consumer to be loyal to us? So actually consumers don't attrite because in some cases, okay, someone gave 5 rupees less. That does happen. I would give you that. But I think that's a very small percentage. Otherwise, we would not have a single enduring brand in our country.
Fair. Very fair. Now, I have a question on this. Like, how do you make sure that you build that loyalty? Like, how do you come at a position? Let's say, giving this example, let's say, why should people listen to this podcast with Kunal, like with Raj, where Kunal is there, versus Kunal going somewhere else? Like, how do I build this? Or how do anyone can build this?
I think you're doing a stellar job already. So, but look, I think it all starts with understanding what the consumer actually wants, right? I think we start with our own views on what the customer wants. And then we try and push the square peg down a round hole and then wonder, why is it not fitting?
Yeah.
Right? It should start with, you know, what does the consumer actually want? That's actually the easy part that many people don't do.
Hmm.
The hard part is actually executing on that requirement. Okay. And why you've been successful in what you do is because you over a period of time have understood what your audience needs. Maybe you're scouring through all the comments and you're talking to many of your listeners and you're meeting your listeners and you're understanding what did they like, what did they not like, right? That's actually still the easy part, which I'm sure many podcast hosts don't do, but you probably do.
Yeah.
The hard part is then integrating those learnings into these conversations. And if you keep doing that over and over again, that's what leads to, that repetition leads to excellence. Right? And that's what creates loyalty then.
Fair, fair. I was telling you a hard part of this when you said, like, ask your customers a question. Sometimes you ask so many people and they give you so many different things that it's very difficult to identify the pattern and be like, oh, these are the 3 things I need to implement in my product or in my service to change that. So do you have a formula for that, or it's just like trial and error? Is like, just keep...
I think you just keep talking to more people. Patterns always emerge. When you talk to enough people, patterns emerge, right? At some point, you have to exercise judgment also. You have to say that, yeah, I heard everyone. Of these things, I feel these 2-3 are most important. And then you run with that. Then you'll see the...
But isn't it opposite to what a lot of leaders say about customers, that, like, you know, Henry Ford has said, if I would have listened to customers, then there'd be faster horses, not cars. Steve Jobs says the same thing. So a lot of... And with all due respect to customers, right? Let's say you are building a company and you know the ins and outs of it, and you are looking at from a bird's point of view and you're listening to 1 million people.
Okay.
But a customer is only looking at a singular point of view. So his point of view about everything which you're doing would be very limited to what you know about the business, right? Do you think their point of view sometimes also becomes an obstacle in your growth? Because
you have to exercise some... It's a fair point. But look, there's a reason we still remember Henry Ford after 100 years, right? Because there's usually one Henry Ford every 100 years, right? So I feel modeling companies and founders modeling behaviors over once in a century type founder, I think it's a slightly risky... Can work. I feel it's slightly risky. I'd rather go with the you know, tried and tested, where the remaining, you know, founders over the last 100 years, how did they build their successful companies? Yeah. I can tell you, there are, while these outlier examples And look, we don't know what was the context in which he said that, right? It just stuck. It's become, every court book probably has it in the world. But we don't know the context, right? We don't know what happened before, what happened after.
We don't even know whether it was him who said it or not.
and we don't know, maybe his mindset changed.
Yeah.
Right? Like, so I'd rather work off first principles and say, look, my job is to delight my customers.
Mm.
I need to understand whether I'm delighting them or not. Right? And then work backwards to say, wherever I'm not delighting them, let me figure out a way to delight them.
Yeah.
I think if we just rinse, repeat, one thing is very certain, we'll start delighting our customers. Huh. And that will drive loyalty.
Mm. That's a very fair point. So you said, this is like the last two questions I'm going to ask you.
Okay.
The first is, like, what do you think, like, what have you identified in founders over a long period of time? Like, in 10 years of their lifetime, okay, yaar, ye do teen cheeze thi, which I think stands out.
Yeah. I would say one thing, right? Because I think once you go into laundry list, you can cover everything.
Cover everything, yeah.
I would say one thing, which is their ability to constantly reinvent themselves. The best founders I know, they have this exceptional ability that every, like, I meet them more often, so I probably see it more frequently, but every year, 2 years, they are just reinventing themselves again and again and again. And not as in, like, they have a calendar set that time to think of reinvention. But actually, it's them... they are so malleable in a good way, right? And that they are able to take in all the external stimuli that they are being exposed to every day. New decision points, new challenges, new crisis, new people. That over a period of time, they just keep evolving, adapting, right? And in a 5-10 year journey, you see an incredible transformation, and usually for the better. In them. The founders who do that often have a high correlation, I've seen, to building really successful companies.
Okay. So do you feel, so let's say the reinvention adaption also comes with constant learning, and constant learning
is... I think it comes with humility, right? More than, like, I think learning can only happen if you have humility.
Yeah.
So they are generally people who are very sure about themselves. Like, they're not insecure about their opinions, that they're always asking, aap bata do, main kya karu. They know what to do. They are confident about their opinions, but they have incredible intellectual humility. They'll come to people who they look up to, who they feel have seen a situation like this before. They'll ask very good questions. They often will not retort also, right? They'll just absorb. Then they'll take it back. They'll talk to two other people. They'll absorb everything, and somewhere it'll become a part of their bloodstream very quickly. But that requires, when you have some amount of success under your belt, it's very hard to have that intellectual humility at the same time. But the best founders have it.
Do that.
They seek out these mentors, advisors, especially for specifics, how to deal with specific situations.
True. And the more specific you are, the better your, like, chances of learning that thing gets. So where do you learn from? Like, can you point out, let's say, a book or a Twitter account or a blog or podcast or a mentor, anyone?
It's all of the above.
Yeah. Right? So all of the, like, give me 2-3 names then. Give me one. Do you use Twitter to learn certain things or no?
Yeah, absolutely.
Who do you follow, like, on Twitter? Yeah, like, who do you like the most?
I'm just very curious person, and have always loved just voraciously consuming knowledge and information, right? Almost sometimes to my own detriment, because then I have so much in my head, which I'm trying to process, but I have this gluttonous mindset towards knowledge and information. I follow news of countries around the world.
Okay.
Right. I don't only follow news of India, right, where I live.
Question is how?
No, I like so a question. Actually, a better question is why.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. No, I'm like, how is like one country ka update nahi ho paata? Kaise 50 countries?
No, okay. Maybe I don't do 50 also, but many, many countries. Hmm. I follow what's going on. I follow their politics.
And why? Why? Okay, so you answer that.
I think there is, it's very hard to explain the whys for some of these things. I think there is always this feeling that, you know, we live in a certain country, we know how it works. How do other countries work? Right? Mm. What can we learn from them? What's going on there that seems to be working or not working?
Mm-hmm.
The other thing I like in terms of topics I've always really enjoyed is how, like just big, big history buff. So most of the things I would watch are something to do with history usually. Okay. Obviously, I'll watch, binge watch the... you know, some top series on the OTT apps, etc.
But tell me your favorite series.
I mean, it's the usual suspects, right? Game of Thrones, Breaking Bad, etc. Obviously watched everything. But what I truly, truly enjoy is, you know, watching documentaries about history,
mm-hmm.
right? History about civilizations. Why did some succeed? Why did some not succeed? You know, right now I'm reading this book called the Lessons of History by Will and Ariel Durant. It's just about a 200-page book.
Yeah.
It's just a stream of essays.
The dark blue colors. It has a machine built on it, something like that? The cover, I think.
It has a oval yellow circle. Mm-hmm. But it's just a very 200 pages. They have a string of essays about lessons from history going back, you know, hundreds, thousands of years.
Okay.
I find that very interesting because I feel in some ways the lifespan that the humans have been around is so short, right? Compared to the history of the universe, history of the planet, and also, you know, the history of civilizations, etc., have also been quite long compared to our individual lifespans. And there's just so much to learn from that, right? It's just... I find it, we live in such an incredible time that there's all this information available that can make us go back to the past and learn what worked, what didn't work, why are we the way we are today? Mm. Often everything is rooted in some historical context. Right? So my single favorite topic to read about, watch things about is just history and going back as far as I can.
Nice. You know, like, so I was, you reminded me of Nikhil Kamath. Okay. So I asked the same question to him and he said, when you read books, don't read the current top favorite ones or the top charted ones, right? Read the ones which have been successful since, let's say, 100 years or the book which talks about 1,000 years before. Yeah. And then see, like, why are they still relevant even today? Because that will tell you a lot about humans and human history and everything.
Yeah.
And that can teach you more things than reading something of today.
Because they're talking about constants, right? Like, you know, you read a book today, some opinions may be expressed in those books. But people are entitled to their opinions, but they're not entitled to their facts.
Yeah.
Right? So the facts don't change. History has happened a certain way, assuming you believe it was documented mostly accurately. It usually never is, but mostly accurately. Then there's a lot to learn from those. Just those facts. Not the opinions, but just the facts.
Nice. So... last two questions. These are the quick ones. I ask them to every guest because these are the ones for me. Well, one is, where do you feel is the next big industry or the next big opportunity for India? Which sector, which industry?
Yeah. You know, recently I went for a health checkup to a specialist. I made an appointment, showed up 5 minutes before, and yet I waited for more than 2 hours. Right. There was no chair, no sitting area, literally standing for 2 hours. And not just me, people before me were standing and there were enough people behind me also who were standing. And I have no problem standing in lines. I've done that all my life. But it made me also, I was not sick. It was just more preventive. But there were some really sick people also who were waiting to see this doctor. And it made me realize, very first, I think we know this, and in COVID, we all saw this also, right? Like, we just don't have, we have very affordable healthcare, but we don't have access. Access commensurate with 1.5 billion people. And I've been thinking since that day and before also that, but particularly since that day, that, you know, come 2040, right? We have 1.5 billion people. Our population has peaked at around 1.5 billion. And then the baby boomer phase of India starts, right? India starts aging. Right now we celebrate, you know, the youthfulness of India. In 15 years, we are going to be starting to think about the aging of India. And I worry about just the whether we are ready for that. Right. And I feel in that probably lie tremendous, uncapped, and innumerous opportunities for founders, where I don't know if we'll be able to build enough hospitals, but I feel we'll be able to create enough technologies that hospital enough that those number of hospitals are not needed. And at least I'm very keen personally to support founders who want very patient capital, because these type of businesses require tremendous patience.
Yeah.
Right? Like literally someone should be okay to stay invested for 5, 10, 15, 20 years, which we can. And so that they can build technologies that can potentially create preventive healthcare, because reactive healthcare for 1.5 billion people, I think we are going to struggle in the next 15, 20 years.
Fair. That's a very detailed and a good answer. I think it's, you just didn't point out, like, let's say, oh, health tech is the next big thing. You gave like an exact guideline. So it acts, I'm sure, like it acts as a starting point for a lot of people who are probably thinking about something like this. Good. So last question of the day is, how do you think we can scale what we are doing right now? Like, what is next for us? Like, I keep asking, like, how can we do this better? How do I make it bigger? How do I make this better?
Then you should first ask yourself what would give you happiness, right? Because I feel that we always, as founders, entrepreneurs, always want to make things bigger, right? Because we somewhere think that bigger is better and better is more happiness. And I always challenge, because I get asked this question by founders more often than you think, which is, you know, how do I grow my business faster, right? In their respective context. And I always ask them that, we'll talk about that, but first also be very clear about where you are headed. I feel that, you know, there is this, I say this often, this even internally in the company, that, you know, there's this Chinese proverb about happiness. It's kind of funny. It says, how does it go? That if you want happiness for an hour, take a nap. If you want happiness for a day, go fishing. If you want happiness for a month, get married. If you want happiness for a year, inherit a fortune. If you want happiness for a lifetime, have a purpose. Right? And I feel that founders should just introspect that, you know, what is that purpose that with which that they are building, that they are building, right? Now, if for from for instance, I can't, I don't know how to grow a business like yours, but you should just think about what is that enduring purpose with which you are building what you're building.
So I have a very good purpose and a problem, which I'll talk about after this podcast. I'll tell you like where I'm coming from and tell me if I'm thinking in the right direction or not. Just that. Like I would love some validation.
Sure.
But thanks a lot for doing this. And I hope you had fun. I hope I made you think about certain things, which usually you don't think about. And you gave pretty golden nuggets for all of us, all our viewers. I'm glad that you did this. Thanks a lot for giving us time.
Thanks, Raj.